This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk here, joining us with the Beat Your Genes podcast. How are you both doing this evening?
Great. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you very much. So we are talking, holidays are coming up. And, well, one holiday just finished. I guess I don't even know if we can call it a holiday, Halloween. But
that's a holiday. What are you talking about? That's the most important holiday of all.
Lots of candy everywhere. But Thanksgiving's coming up. And, the winter holidays are coming up as well. And so I've gotten a couple of questions from people just trying to figure out a little bit more about the pleasure trap. And so a couple of listeners sent me an article recently that's been in the news. So I think it came out last week from the New York Times. And it's called How to Feel Nothing in Order to Feel More Later. And so the catchy title was talking about something called dopamine fasting. So I wanted to get both the doctors' takes on this. So apparently there's these three businessmen. I say businessmen lightly because they're in their early 20s and they're these startup founders and business kids. Yeah. And so they're trying to do this thing called dopamine fasting, and the doctor who they interviewed for this article is a professor at UCFS Medical School. And he says that, dopamine is just a mechanism that explains how addictions can become reinforced. And he goes, but the title is not to be taken literally. So he says it should actually be called stimulation fasting. And so, mm-hmm. It's interesting how they did this. They don't eat. They don't look at any screens. They don't listen to any music. They don't exercise. They don't touch any other bodies physically. They don't do any work, no eye contact, no talking more than absolutely necessary. What's funny is the photographer can take their picture, but there shouldn't be any flash. So what they're saying is they're hoping to be eventually doing an ultimate dopamine fast, which is completely sensory deprivation. And so Dr. Lyle, you wrote the book on the pleasure trap, and Dr. Hawk, you do consultations with patients who are, trying to essentially decrease the stimulation when it comes to food. So I wanted to hear your take on these things, on this dopamine fasting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll jump in because I saw this article across my feed last week too. It was really making the rounds. And I think this is, there's a couple of things going on here. It's a case of people knowing just enough to be dangerous and to come up with some whiz kid business plan associated with it. So there's a fancy word like dopamine that they don't actually really understand what that means or what it describes. And so they are just trying to think of a way to monetize the age old practice of virtue signaling, basically. So there's nothing wrong with dopamine per se. The dopamine is, this is a natural signal that the brain is giving you to tell you that you're doing the right thing. So primarily associated with food and sex. This is the body's way of letting you know that you are on the right path for survival and reproduction. And for people who have heard us talk about the pleasure trap before, they know that part of what's going on with the pleasure trap, a big part of what's going on with the pleasure trap, is that the hyper-normal, supernormal foods in the modern environment are essentially hijacking those pleasure pathways in the brain, and they're giving you an extra, extra big dose of this pleasure chemical in the brain, essentially, that is making you unable to make appropriate decisions about whether to continue engaging in that behavior or not. So this is the idea that you can do some kind of end run around that process completely by going on some kind of fast from it is a really cute little way to monetize a new idea in Silicon Valley, but it's not actually going to make you immune to the siren song of the pleasure trap, whether that's from food or from social media screens or anything else. So, you know, people can take a little break from things and they will feel just like people who come to True North or come to the fasting escape and they take a little break from super normal stimuli in high calorie dense food, whether they're fasting or just eating a healthy whole food plant-based diet, you know, healthy food tastes a lot better to you after you've abstained entirely from food for a while, because you've reset your palate and you've readjusted to the natural pleasure that is associated, that you're supposed to feel by doing something that is going to contribute to your survival, like eating good food. But it doesn't make you any more immune to supernormal stimuli when you go past Haagen-Dazs later that day. The supernormal stimuli is still supernormal stimuli. So that's kind of part one of what I would be concerned about with this whole thing and the whole misguided nature of this process. The other is that I can't help but see some serious status shenanigans going on here. Like there's a lot of virtue signaling of purity and abstinence, and I, you know, it's very enlightenment trap adjacent. This is age old practices of withdrawing from worldly concerns and tuning into higher information and essentially opting out of competition in the way that we talk about it with the pleasure trap. It's also a little bit of, the enlightenment traps. And there's also, I mean, these guys are avoiding everything from, it's I'm on a dopamine fast, so I can't talk to you. I can't go on a date. I can't make eye contact. There's some serious competitive avoidance and impression management here where it can be very convenient to go on a dopamine fast instead of going on a date that might not go well, or going to a big meeting at work that might not go well. So it's always worthwhile when you're baffled by something like this that floats across your social media feed to investigate where the status is. And I think there's a lot of that in play here. So that's my two cents on it. It's ridiculous.
Incredible.
I'll let Doug jump in if he has anything else to add.
More like $100. That's not 2 cents. Great. Terrific. Yeah.
That's incredible.
All done.
Dr. Hawk, yeah, it sounds like you hit the nail right on the head, because I'm going to quote to you an article from a quote from this article. It says their usual schedule of all day, every day hacking away on different projects was too much. Investors and clients had demand. Their startup iterations had turned into a real job. And quote of one of the guys here, I'd never thought about fasting work. And once there was pressure on work, it became less fun. And I thought maybe we'll try fasting instead.
Yes. How terribly convenient that is. Yeah. Yeah. And it's beyond reproach as far as, it's just like when you're on a cleanse, you know, you can misuse these things in ego trappy and enlightenment trappy kinds of ways to avoid the more difficult work of actually changing your diet long-term. But it's very beyond criticism to say, well, I'm on a dopamine fast, so I can't be expected to do that difficult thing at work today or have that difficult social interaction. So very handy little excuse, especially when it's got the seal of approval of the moment by, you know, being published in New York Times and being the story of the moment on everyone's Facebook feed.
Well, Dr. Hawk, I appreciate your explanation, because it really gets to the heart of the truth of the matter, which is that we've got to be working rather than trying to float by literally and figuratively.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
All right. Our next question.
Cool.
Imagine a 20-year-old male. Every day he plays video games, eats Twinkies, drinks Mountain Dew, binge watches Netflix, mindlessly scrolls through social media, and watches pornography. What are the long-term and shorter-term effects of all this supernormal stimuli? Is it too much dopamine? Is too much dopamine detrimental in the long run?
I don't think I heard anything in there. I didn't hear anything about drugs or alcohol. So
no, just Mountain Dew.
This is all right, Mountain Dew. So this is all minor league. There are no long-term effects of this. There's this is nothing other than this brain is being enticed into this sort of a world of supernormal stimuli that's not damaging But all this individual really needs, if I'm going to imagine this individual, I don't have to imagine one. I live with one of these. What they need is called an apartment.
Rent due on the first.
They need rent due. They need an electric bill, and they need a refrigerator that's empty. That's all they need. That's they're having an empty refrigerator deficiency syndrome. And as soon as they face that syndrome gets taken care of, then it's all the problems go away.
We need a good acronym for that.
Yes, that's what that is. No harm done. I have HCNC parents who will call me up and wonder about their son that's, you know, sort of a bright ne'er-do-well who's not accomplishing anything, and they're afraid because, you know, the kid might have made some halfway suicidal noise, you know, 5 years ago. So God forbid we put any pressure on him. And and he's occasionally depressed and, you know, had a girlfriend for a week and then got dumped. So that's a bad thing. So now is not the time to actually, you know, make him face the refrigerator deficiency syndrome.
Well, we just talked about fasting. Yes. Maybe that is the refrigerator deficiency.
So there's the solution so far in my career, I don't know how many times I've forced the hands of parents successfully, probably no more than maybe a dozen. But I believe that whatever the number is, I'm pretty sure my batting average is 100%. So 100%, there's a miracle occurs when the deficiency syndrome kicks in. A miracle of responsibility and effective behavior. So that's the only problem that exists here is that the organism is simply responding to its context. And if the context says I can be stimulating, you know, lazily stimulating, hyperstimulating the dopamine pathway and not doing anything to get there, no effort to get there, then that's what it's going to do. And it's going to do that so long as we provide the context that that's what it can do. That's what I call an animal in a zoo. And so we let him out of the zoo. We open up the cage. We don't just let him out. We kick him out. Kick him out in the wild. Make him forage.
Yeah.
They get affected very quickly. Yeah. So that's the answer to that question.
It's a new phenomenon that people have become, you know, this way because of, you know, the stimuli in the modern environment, or that there's something wrong culturally with these kids today or something like that. But it is just a function of the fact that we've got more people effectively living in the zoo than ever. It's the most abundant, benign, you know, safest environment that humans have ever lived in for their entire natural history. And so people who are more on the side of the bell curve to, you know, live contentedly in the zoo and drink Mountain Dew and watch porn and not engage in self-esteem processes around big competitive goals are more likely to do it. So yeah, you just got to kick more people out.
Yes. And notice they put porn at the end of the question. They really should have put it first. Like ingredients in the cereal, you know what I mean? We're supposed to put the biggest ingredient first.
Video games and come first, and so we wind our way down to porn. Yeah, well, you know, he's living his best life.
All right, let's go on.
Well, I actually wanted to sidetrack a little bit because you said that in your career you've bat 100, but you've been successful at having the parents do this, you know, a dozen times or so. What is it about parents and children that you think is preventing children from listening? I mean, parents from listening to you.
Oh yeah. No, my success there is low. The parents are just terrified. And so, you know, particularly moms are terrified. It's not always mom that's terrified, but it usually is. So mom's terrified, inherently, you know, more sensitive and worried about her little cub, and worried about the little hurts that he's suffered. Mm-hmm. and can't quite picture, you know, I try to draw this picture. This person talks about 20-year-olds. That same 20-year-old was storming the beaches of Normandy, okay, mm-hmm. under German, incredible German howitzer fire. That's what that nervous system is capable of. And so the fact that now we're worried about it actually having to go down to, God forbid, Taco Bell and apply for a job. You know, right in the middle of Bakersfield. Like, oh my God, this is going to be really hard.
Okay.
Going to have to walk for, and you know, he doesn't have, you know, his dad took away the car because there was some, you know, problems. So dad put the foot down. So he'd have to ride his bike down there. It's like 6 blocks.
Oh God.
So
really,
this is usually, yeah, this is just, you know, naturally sensitive, worried people, miscalibrated as to what it takes to get a, you know, to get some creature out of this horrendous energy conservation trap. This is an animal in a zoo, and you got to open up the cage and you got to put your foot in their rear end and push them out. And the parents are very worried about this a lot of times. And so, yeah, I'm not always successful. I'm very often not successful getting the parents to follow through. But when I am successful getting to follow through, it works like a charm. That's how it works. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. All right. Our next question. I feel like I'm stuck in a diet mindset where my internal audience won't recognize any of my efforts unless I'm 100% compliant all of the time, which basically means I have to log everything I eat and closely monitor my weight. Essentially, I feel like I'm not trying hard enough when I just follow a plant-based diet. I can maintain my weight without weighing anything, but I don't get the positive feedback from my internal audience unless I'm super strict. Is this because my audience knows that I have a cheat meal once a week? I would like to lose maybe 10 pounds, but enjoying life a little bit is more important to me than losing a little bit of weight. Is my internal audience telling me that in reality, losing 10 pounds is more important, or why am I feeling this way and can't stop feeling guilty if I'm not perfect 100% of the time? Considering all the crap other people eat, I feel like I should be able to have one meal a week that's not 100% whole food plant-based and still be fine and not feel all this guilt. What say you?
I can jump in on this one too. So this is, you're trying to negotiate with the internal audience, and negotiating with the internal audience is like trying to negotiate with an IRS auditor. Like the internal audience, it knows if you've been good or bad. It knows when you've been sleeping. It knows everything. And it's making an accurate assessment of how it's essentially, if the internal audience is agitated and it's giving you negative feedback, which it is in your case, it's because it knows, and it knows because you know that you're leaving competitive chips on the table. And in this case, it's your cheat meal. It's those 10 pounds. Your internal audience is saying, hey, you are potentially selling yourself short of your potential competitive standing in relation to these competitive domains that you're in, because you were indulging in this cheat meal every week. And you're trying to have a rational discussion about how you know, quote unquote, value your social life and living a happy life more than you value those 10 pounds, but you don't actually know that because you haven't lost the 10 pounds. And so the internal audience just knows that all the situation is that you're putting yourself at a systematic competitive disadvantage. And so you're not going to make any headway as far as overcoming that dissonance until you get more information about whether it's true that there is a big happiness difference there, and that experiment that you should run would be one of extreme diligence about cutting out the cheat meal, about really applying yourself completely in a very devoted, diligent, really all in sort of way for some constrained amount of time, and see if that impresses the internal audience. And if you meet that goal, if it quiets down as far as indulging from time to time, if you're able to maintain it that way. So you can do that by, you know, you could just stay at home and be super compliant, like you've talked about, that you have some experience with that. But it might be easier if you're approaching this in some kind of time-limited experimental way. I mean, this is what makes the fasting escape and places like it so great, because you can really just get yourself into that environment where everybody is doing that, and you're really just all in for some constrained short period of time to get more information to recalibrate the internal audience if it needs to be recalibrated. But I would say that it's, you know, the fact is that cheat meal, depending on how indulgent you are on that cheat meal, people can be quite indulgent on their cheat meal every week. Let's say it's 1,000 calories a week. You know, you're easily cutting your calorie deficit for the week in half or more. So if you are trying to lose 10 pounds, you're slowing that way down to, you know, it's going to take you years, if at all. And you may be keeping yourself just at a complete equilibrium, which it sounds like you might be. So this is an experiment. It's a short experiment, and it's easily enough done by checking yourself into jail for a while. So that's what I would recommend, just to get the most information the most efficiently, and to move forward with armed with better information for both you and your internal audience.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, excellent.
I appreciate the plug to Fasting Escape. You know,
yeah,
True North calls them the True North Navigators. I think McDougal's program, they call them the McDougalers. So at Fasting Escape, we call them the Fasting Escapees. So,
That's great.
Yeah.
I like that.
Perfect. Yeah, well, you know.
Happy
owned. True North is great too. Also a great option for people who want to check themselves into jail. It's just usually booked out several months ahead of time. So I think people could get into your place a little quicker, more likely. So True North, you're on a long waiting list.
Well, fascinating. Right. Thank you so much. Yeah. All right. Our next question. I understand your view, Dr. Lyle, on how to handle questions about things like why do you eat that way, etc. However, I'm wondering about what to say when people say things like, oh, I really need to do something about my weight, so I've just started eating the low-carb, high-fat diet. Or questions or things like, I have diabetes, so I can't eat pasta or carbs or potatoes. Lately, my response has been to smile and say nothing. However, I'm left feeling frustrated that there was so much that I could contribute to the conversation, but I have to hold back. What's the best approach when people say or do things that are either simply wrong or not the best solution, particularly when you care about the other person and want to be helpful?
There's a number of considerations with this question. And one of the things that I have a lecture that some people that are listening have probably heard. It's called Getting Along Without Going Along. And it's really the story of the esteem dynamics that are involved in these interactions with other people around food. Certainly the principles apply to everything, but it's particularly dicey around food. People aren't going to argue with someone who's got an alcohol problem that is saying, hey, I need to abstain. I'm turning over my wine glass. People are respectful of that, generally speaking. And with cigarettes or something like that. But with food, they're not going to be, because almost everybody on the other side of the table is, eating kind of whatever it is that they want, and that they believe that it's healthy enough. And so these disagreements that would form are going to be sensitive, because it puts us into these camps of, I know more than you do, and I'm more conscientious than you are. And so that winds up being the esteem signal that comes from anybody who's going to educate, preach, or demonstrate superiority in the dietary arena. So my general suggestion about this is to completely stay out of it. There are multiple reasons for that. The chief reason is that the people on the other side are very likely to be defensive about this, which means what we mean by that is it means that they are feeling that they're in a one down position in terms of the esteem dynamic, that you are preaching and looking down at their inferior behavior and inferior knowledge. And therefore, they're going to attempt to defend that position or defend their status. So they're basically going to be saying, no, you're mistaken. I am not lower in conscientiousness, and I am not lower in my information quality. My behavior is not less integrated around intelligence and conscientiousness than what you're suggesting. And in fact, you're wrong and I'm right. Okay, so that's almost certainly the reaction that you're going to get off the other side. That's going to be the unconscious status defense mechanisms that are going to be elicited by any kind of advice that you're going to give. Now, so that's, you think mistakenly, what's tripping inside the heads of our questioner here and the heads of anybody that's in this situation is going to be the notion that you have information that they do not have, and that they will recognize that you have information that they don't have, and that they will be relieved and happy and excited to have been enlightened. And therefore, it will raise your esteem in the village, that they will signal to others your wisdom and your intelligence, and their gratitude for the fact that you enlightened them. Okay? That's what your Stone Age brain is thinking, because that's what you believe to be the case. And so that's what you, so you're being lured in by instincts that what I call, this is what I call the teaching gene. So this is a major reason why humans dominate the earth. I mean, there's probably 10, probably a list of 10 things that we could say that are responsible for human world domination. But one of them certainly is the fascination with teaching. Teaching is a way that we demonstrate to the village that we have value to the village, because we knew things that people in the village didn't know. Okay. So probably nothing tickles the instinct of people more today. Let's face it, the pleasure trap and its impact, for example, not just on health, but more importantly on weight, is the single largest factor in self-esteem, mating success, self-confidence in this arena. In other words, it is basically, it is the number one personal goal of the Western world, for God's sakes. So as a result, if you believe sincerely that you have the answer, and you've done enough looking into it that you're confident, you're very confident that you're correct, then it would, you know, we can just see the teaching gene rubbing its hands in glee, just waiting for the opportunity to enlighten somebody who's mistaken. Okay. And what should be on the other side of that, since we are laying down the golden stepping stones to them getting out of this terrible dilemma that they've been in for years or decades, that they should be, in fact, kissing us all over our faces and our back end because we enlightened them and showed them the light.
Okay.
Now, so point is that this is not going to happen. They are not going to recognize that you're the Messiah. They're going to have instincts that recognize that you are disagreeing with them in their position, and that they have heard from authorities. Don't think that they came up with this idea out of whole cloth, out of thin air. No, they listened to an authority and they believed in that authority. So now who are you? Okay. So it's one thing if you're T. Colin Campbell and you say to your little niece, listen, Sarah, let me explain how the facts of life to you. But what if we're just a regular person? You're actually contradicting some person's authority figure that they have. They looked at it enough, and it probably wasn't the first authority that they listened to. They listened to probably a several and a few, and probably had some friend of theirs that turned them on to this, and then they bought into it. They've got, you know, quite a bit of confidence that they're right. And when you contradict them, they're not going to believe you at all. So this isn't you telling everybody, listen, the rattlesnakes are behind the red rock over there at the turn of the river. Don't go over there. Okay. It's like, it's clear that this is true to you, and you can tell them and they'll believe you and they'll be grateful, because they're like, wow, I was just going to walk over there to get some peaches, but now I'll be careful. Okay. They would be grateful for information that valuable. this feels like it's information that valuable, and it is. However, it's not going to be believed, and it's going to be perceived as a status-seeking threat, and they're going to defend themselves, and you're going to wind up in an argument. And now it's we've got blood in the water, and we've got a disturbed esteem dynamic between two people. And now you're bitter because they're not giving you the credit you deserve. And now they're bitter because you're looking down your nose at them. And now we're disagreeing, and it's just a mess. Okay. So my attitude is opt out, which is what this person's doing. And if you feel enormously compelled, first of all, anybody that you told, listen, the answer to your diabetes is start already eating pasta and potatoes and vegetables and get rid of the cheese and the pork. Okay. The odds of them being able to do that successfully approach zero. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to do it anyway. Okay, so just get it out of your head that you just laid down the golden stepping stones. Now you're going to get a bunch of credit for it because you didn't lay down anything. They're not going to believe you. They're not going to do it. And even if they did believe you and they tried to do it, they won't do it. So now it's not going to work. And now they look bad because they didn't follow through on your prescription. And it's a mess. Any way you look at this thing, it's a mess. So here's the better suggestion. If you can't keep your mouth shut, this is how you'd say it. You'd say, you know, that I'm kind of in this health thing and I'm kind of into it. And, you know, there's a book that talks about this, like with the diabetes, Neil Barnard's book, for example. You know, and this is what I would say, very important. I would say, I'm not sure this guy's right about everything, but it seems to work for some people. You might want to give it a try sometime. That's how I would do it. Okay. That way, I'd say, you might want to give it a try sometime. Not, you might want to give it a try, like next week, and then you can report to me in 4 weeks how you're doing. No, this is an interesting book. I've looked into it. I read part of it, seemed to make some sense. You know, apparently a lot of people have some success with this. Not sure he's right about everything, but hey, you might want to try it sometime. That's what I would do. Okay. And that way you've sensitized them to the possibility that there may be an alternative way of doing this that they hadn't considered. But you haven't done it in any way that's threatening, in any way that indicates that you know more than they do, or that there's an answer and that their answer that they're pursuing is incorrect. That's how I would do that. And those are all the host of considerations that go into my prescriptions. As you can see, it's pretty deep. It's pretty complicated. In other words, there's a lot of reasons why I am super quiet and careful. Okay. And I, you know, hey, listen. I've been at this thing for 40 years, and I have upset a lot of people, okay? But I probably upset my last person before my 40th birthday. So I doubt that there's anybody in the last 20 years that I have irritated with this information, right? Why? Because I lost so many of these hands, you know, in the first 20 years of doing this. So this is, I've got a lot of social scars on my back from people that I upset and threatened and, you know, relationships that I disturbed because I was following my instincts, right down the line and really being completely honest and open and saying, listen, I just got to tell you, you're heading down the wrong direction. This is the right way to go. Okay. And guess what? A PhD and big time academic credentials and big time affiliation with big time authors in this, that wasn't enough. Okay, so therefore, if it wasn't enough for me, if I never pulled this off successfully, I don't think the odds of anybody's pulling this off are high. So be humble, lead with humility, and lead with humility about the quality of the information. Open them up to the possibility, and then that's it, and we're done.
Yeah, great holiday advice.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, right on time. be meeting with all the family and friends. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Lau, to the people who might say that they don't feel guilty or that in addition to doing it for status, they also have a little voice in their head that says that can imagine that when that person finally gets sick or gets a stroke or something, then they say, well, you know this information. Why didn't you say something sooner?
Mm-hmm.
To them, yeah. What do you say to those people?
Well, let's keep in mind, let's back up for just a minute. People spend a fortune coming to the McDougal program or to Engine 2. They spend less going to a place like True North or Fasting Escape. They read books. They listen to Chef AJ's, endless, relentless cheerleading and support. And yet they struggle. These are highly motivated, totally convinced, committed individuals. Okay. So let's keep in mind that it isn't even remotely the case that the difference between them succeeding and failing was you saying, oh, listen, well, I just really got to tell you the information, this is what you should do. It's like that, even vehemently, the statistical odds of them taking and running with it and that being the difference between success and failure in their life is like less than 1%. Okay, so chill out, give yourself a break. And if you're dying of guilt, 17 years from now when somebody dies of a heart attack, but at 78 because they didn't turn their life around when the first one came at 61 and their diabetes started, then go to a brain surgeon and have them take a laser and laser out the guilt chip. That's the solution to the problem.
Excellent. And I'm not sure my health insurance covers that, but I'll look into it.
All right.
Problem.
Oh my.
All right.
All right. What else we got?
All right. Our next question. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Hawk.
Just going to add in that case too. It's not as if you've been, you don't. The answer that Dr. Lyle's given to that question does not stop. It doesn't mean that you're sitting on your hands and not leading by example that whole time. So the information is still available to them in the form of the life that you're living. So they're perfectly capable of watching you and you're thriving and you show up to holidays and they see that you're eating differently than they are. And if they're motivated and they run the CB, they can ask you about it. And God knows you people are going to be happy to tell them for all the reasons that Doug just outlined, but you're not preaching. You're not putting them into this trap where they're going to feel status threatened. You're sitting there with the information on demand as it's asked for. So, which is all that you could do. You would never have put them in a better position by hitting them over the head with it and shoving it down their throats. So it's you don't have to hide it from anybody, which I sometimes people will hear this advice and that's how they interpret it. You just are not preaching it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I needed to hear that because this new movie that came out, Game Changers, I've watched it several times already, and I've had to battle my own intuition to try to preach it to all, friends and other people that are in my life besides patients here. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. All good.
All right. Our next question, dear doctors, I am a 28-year-old male. Over the last 6 months, I have lost 30 pounds on a high carbohydrate, low fat, ketogenic diet. Maybe that's a typo, but I struggled with weight for years prior to this. My previously normal lipid profile is unchanged. I'm impressed with the data behind a whole foods plant-based diet, but felt that this wasn't something I could stick with long-term. I've read in the pleasure trap strategies for telling others to buzz off, but I still don't like the social implications of being a young male vegan. Do you have any long-term concerns for being on this diet, and would you recommend it for anyone?
Yeah, he's a couple of different questions in there. It sounds like there's some questions about the validity of the diet and the long-term health implications of the diet, but also some of the social implications. And I think that, when someone is concerned about the social implications of being a young male vegan, a lot of that is because of the reputation that vegans have for this pushy preaching that we've been talking about. So along the lines of the last question, there's absolutely no reason to make what you're eating your identity. If you're not going into veganism primarily out of some sort of ethical motivation. And there are people who do that. That was my first entry into this world, was an ethical justification for avoiding animal products. That's one thing. And some people desire to hitch their identity to that because it's part of their sexual display to the world. And that's fine. Like that, if that's what you're doing and that's the business that you're in, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But if that it gives you concerns or you don't want to be associated with that identity, there's nothing about eating this way that requires you to put new bumper stickers on your car or to announce to everybody that you're vegan or even to announce that anyone that you're plant-based. You're just a person who eats more healthfully. You eat more whole natural food. And if it's not something that you're comfortable with for the rest of your life, you know, going 100% plant-based, there's, you know, very little, if any, evidence that there's any substantive difference between a 100% plant-based diet and a merely 100% plant-based diet that includes a little bit of animal food, you know, as long as you're avoiding dairy in particular, which is the one thing that we're sort of really trying to steer people away from. But we're essentially trying to mimic a true ancestral diet, which, contrary to many of the claims of the paleo people, is not a giant hunk of meat with a sprig of parsley, but it's a primarily plant-based diet with a smattering of animal food from time to time when you can get it, if that's something that you value and you don't want to give up. The health implications of that are pretty minor compared to a really perfect, entirely plant-based diet. This again is assuming that you're not going vegan for ethical reasons, which is a separate thing. So I would separate out that whole question, and, you know, release yourself from that obligation to make any big pronouncements about any big dietary changes. You're just trying to eat more healthfully. You know, you don't owe anybody an explanation about your diet ever, and you can just really downplay this as much as needed. And then as far as long-term concerns for a whole food plant-based diet, there really are none, other than, you know, you're going to want to supplement with B12. Most people, regardless of what sort of diet they're eating, should probably be supplementing with B12. That's really it. This is overall certainly the healthiest diet for pretty much everything that would ail anybody. In general, I think we would recommend it to pretty much anyone who would be seeking a big dietary change, but with the caveat that, you know, a little bit of animal food is not a deal breaker in this case.
Fascinating. All right. Well, we have a caller who's been on hold for a couple minutes, so we'd like to welcome. Caller, welcome to the show. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Well, I'm calling from Palm Springs, California. I heard my name mentioned. This is Chef AJ.
Chef AJ.
Well, thank you. You know, you mentioned I'm a cheerleader, but I don't feel like a cheerleader around the holidays. Why do I get so depressed at Thanksgiving? What is it? It's not just me. What about the holidays make normal people sad?
That's a Dr. Lauren question.
Well, who knows? I'm sad because there's a lot of money that's going to go out. I've got a lot of little people that I need to give money to so that they can buy me a present. I think that certainly holiday time will call into relief some interesting things about our histories and the state of our relationships with maybe family members and friends, et cetera, that can be uncomfortable. There can be some distances that have been put up, and either physical distances where we miss people or psychological distances that remain distant. And therefore we can feel sort of unconnected from our pack more than we might normally. So I think those are maybe some of the reasons for that. But aside from that, there's no in principle reason why the holidays should be difficult. They're in theory, they're supposed to be a joyful time. I remember the Harry Met Sally Harry would say, yeah, I'm just trying to get through from Thanksgiving to New Year's. everybody's life circumstances are different. Some people love that time. Other people, you know, it's a time with some consternation and some loneliness and some, you know, concern, reflection on relationships and their circumstances. So, yeah, these are individual differences, not only in personalities, but also in personal circumstances. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Reflection in general, like the cycle of the year, you know, I think people are kind of a little bit conditioned to tune in this time of year to wonder about, you know, did I accomplish what I set out to accomplish? Am I where I want to be in life? Am I in the kinds of relationships I would like to be in? And very often for most people, the answers to one or more of those questions are no. And so they're getting kind of, you know, feelings are always feedback. They're feedback from the nervous system that is letting you know whether you're on track or not. And so that is valuable information from your nervous system, letting you know that you probably should make some changes to improve some of those situations in a lot of cases.
Oh, yeah. That's good. I like that a lot. It's good thinking.
That's wonderful. Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that we're storing up for winter and trying to see if we have enough insurance to last us through the winter? Friends insurance,
I think that's possible. I don't think that's the holidays per se, but certainly the weather changes are likely to cause a low grade anxiety in the system behind that I think is going to be natural for people. So I think it's very likely to be the case that there's some of that. But AJ's got something else rattling around. What are you thinking, AJ?
No, I was just wondering if you have any advice on how to, you know, make them more joyous. Because I don't think it's just me, doctors. I mean, I hear from a lot of people that this time of year is just incredibly stressful.
Yeah, it's very. People are also trying to, you know, there's a lot of display that goes along with this time of year too, where people will get themselves into a very stressful situation because they're trying to orchestrate a big holiday or they're trying to make a big event. And so there's a lot of esteem tied up with that. So, you know, people, particularly women, will try to create a big event for the whole family. And they've invested a lot in that process and they have a lot on the line in terms of like what kind of esteem they're expecting to get back from other people. And then they very often are not getting that kind of esteem back from their family members, which leads to conflict. And I think all of this to some degree also is a little bit of a conditioned process. You know, people kind of come to expect that the holidays are going to be either joyous or depressing, depending on their previous experiences. And they kind of gear up emotionally for that sort of experience and create situations that recreate and re-perpetuate that whole feeling scape. But I, you know, spend the time with the people that you love the most, who you're in the most positive esteem feedback loops with, and try not to overextend yourself and spend too much money and get depressed about overindulging with food and having this, you know, feedback loop with the pleasure trap and the internal audience, you know, chirping away at you, and all of these things are going to get people down. And so all of that is very understandable, I think.
Gosh.
Okay, so the people I love the most would be the dog. So, okay.
Yeah, that's what I...
There you go.
Yeah, the pet cemetery has way more flowers than the regular cemetery.
Oh, you guys crack me up.
Now that's all just great stuff, Jen. I really, there's so much in there. I wish we had a transcript of it because there's so many points that she hit there, and you know, all those things reverberate across my history. You know, all that kind of stuff, and it gets down to, for me, stripping it down to who are the very few people that I really enjoy spending time with, and just spend time with them and let everything else go. You know.
Yeah,
if you want to go watch a hockey game, you know, on Christmas, go watch it, you know, with somebody that you would really have a raucous time with. And this thing doesn't have to look like it's, quote, supposed to look. It should look, it should feel like it is that you want it to feel. So that's how we want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, speaking
thank
of
you.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Chef AJ, very much for calling. We always love to hear your voice on this program.
Love the show. Thanks, guys. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Yeah. Speaking of transcripts, by the way, one of our listeners, I don't want to say his full name because I haven't actually asked him if he doesn't mind if I reveal his name, but his name is Doug.
Yeah.
But he is actually putting together a list of all of our shows with the transcripts on there. He's the moderator of our Facebook group, the Fans of the Beat Your Jeans podcast. If you guys join over there, I'm sure he'll provide a link for that. So,
it's their. So he already has one that is created that is auto-generated transcript. So there are there's some errors and a little bit of the computer kind of, you know, makes up words sometimes. But as far as I know, that does exist. There is a lot of that in the Facebook group and the document there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. So thank you to the other Doug.
Brought together. So yes, all hail Team Doug.
All right, very good. Well, that's our questions for tonight. We'll go over the rest of them. We've got a couple of deeper ones for next week.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for coming on. We really love it. And Dr. Hawk, really appreciate the in-depth explanations of these. Answered a lot of little questions I've had in my head about these. So yeah, really appreciate it.
Good.
Terrific, everybody.
Anytime.
Thank you, Nathan.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
all right.
You.
Have a good night. Before we forget, Dr. Jen Hawk actually has a website you can actually book a phone consult with her either through Dr. Lyle's website. Is it esteemdynamics.com and then just select Dr. Jen Hawk. Is that right? Yeah. Tell us how they can reach you.
Yeah. They can either reach me that way or they can just go to my website, which is jenhawk.com, H-O-W-K. I have my schedules the same on both sites. So you can book either place or I also have various videos and info that you can learn more about me and watch things and read things. It does exist.
Absolutely. And the videos that Dr. Hawk has put out are just incredible. I mean, if you liked her explanations today and some of the other shows, Dr. Hawk, you really get to wind out on some of these in-depth explanations like agreeable versus disagreeable people and some dating questions, some romance questions. So all in all, a lot of good content in there. And if you got some questions, go ahead and book a consult. I've had a couple of patients here at the Fasting Escape who have booked a consult with Dr. Hawk, and they've told me, she's just the nicest person on the phone and helped them solve problems that they haven't been able to solve for a long time through a lot of different therapists. So it comes highly recommended from a lot of people. So
that's really good to hear. Well,
just great.
Team Nate, I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to talking to you both coming up in the next show.
Fantastic. Yep, we'll see you soon, Nathan.
All right. Good
night.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourjeans.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Jeans, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.